refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar. Refi Revival, stay ahead of the curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today.
Welcome to Market Advantage, the monthly podcast from Optimal Blue. Tune in for valuable insights from the Market Advantage Mortgage Data Report and in-depth conversations with industry experts. Stay competitive and optimize your advantage in the ever-evolving mortgage landscape.
Welcome to the Market Advantage podcast. I have Optimal Blue Head of Corporate Strategy, Mike Vogue, co-hosting with me. Our friend and data aficionado, Brennan O'Connell, is actually away on paternity leave.
Congrats, Brennan. We're really pumped for you and your family, but we're excited for you to come back as well.
That's right. So, Mike, I know you've joined us on the podcast before, and you'll be joining us regularly now, but the timing today is especially prudent, I think, because last month we added a significant number of new data metrics to our monthly report, including an entire section dedicated to the secondary market, which is an area of expertise for you. So to kick us off, why don't you share some highlights from June's data findings?
Thanks, Olivia. And I'm going to actually do counter to what people think I would do here. And I'm not going to start with the hedging data and the secondary data. I'm going to come back to that. There are some big takeaways here that I wanted to start with. So first of all, overall volume increased almost 2% this month. And I think the biggest driver here is that we did see rates drop a fair amount going into the end of the month here. To build off that point, OBMMI declined to 6.67 to end the month, which is down 17 basis points from where we started. This is super interesting because it actually moved lockstep with the 10-year treasury. So the 10-year treasury was also down 17 basis points, which kept that spread between the two static at 2.43. That's a big one because that is the extra yield that investors require to buy a mortgage-backed asset as opposed to a treasury/risk-free asset. So the demand for that asset was basically flat month over month. And we've gotten out of a big period where that spread was very wide. So it's nice to at least see it be static. On an origination front, to just go a little bit deeper, our refinance share increased from 16 to 18%. And this is down from where it was beginning of the year, where it was in the mid-20s. But it did increase from last month, which was a nice sign. Purchase activity was flat month over month. And while that might seem kind of ho-hum, compared to how we looked at things historically, May to June usually has a drop, anywhere from 4 to 5% in purchase activity as you see the spring buying season start to slow as folks are going on summer vacations and things like that. So to see it kind of flat was actually a good sign in this case. The next data point that I want to cover is percentage of ARMs originated. I want to give a shout out to Jim Glenn and Kevin Foley, who went into great detail on this on the last podcast that they put out. We saw the ARM population decrease from 9.1 to 8.81. This typically goes in lockstep with what we see in the industry as term premium. This is typically the extra yield that investors require for a longer dated debt obligation. So for example, typically an investor should require less interest rate for a 2-year than a 10-year, right? There's more risk with that 10-year paper than the 2-year paper. And right now, we see that term premium as 52 basis points between the 2 and 10-year treasury. Last month, it was 56 basis points. And a year ago, it was negative 30 basis points. That actually tracks really nicely with the uptick in ARM originations that we've seen year to date, and also just the conversations that we've had. We've had a lot of conversations on the trading desk about ARMs. We've had a whole podcast just dedicated to ARMs. So it's nice to see that increase, but we did see that decrease this month. And now I'm going to do the typical Mike Vogue thing. I'm going to jump right into the hedging stats. You know, the big one that I want to call it this month, and this is the second month that we've been showing these stats, is what we call our hedge loan statistics. And this is the percentage of loans that are sold to a specific loan sale execution. We typically break this down between loans sold to the agency cash window, loans securitized as a Fannie or Freddie Mac backed security or Jenny Mae security. We have loans that are actually sold best efforts at the point of loan sale, which is kind of counterintuitive, but we do see that happen. And then loans sold to aggregators via a bulk execution. And the big kind of takeaway here is that we saw loans sold to aggregators down almost 3 points month over month. It was 38% the previous month and 35% this month. And it was actually completely countered by an increase in agency-backed share. So if it was either, it was up 2% for loans sold to the cash window and then 2% loans sold via MBS securitization. And that's really interesting given just a lot of the headlines out there. You see the agencies get back a little bit more of that share. Another interesting tidbit from the capital market / secondary market side was loan sale by price. And this is where we track where folks actually are selling their loans. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but there are instances where folks are not selling to the highest price. There's a number of reasons why that happens, whether that is things such as eligibility mix, things such as representative mix, which means, hey, you want to make sure that each investor has that specific slice of your loan population that corresponds with your overall, right? If you had a specific geo or credit exposure, you wouldn't want one investor to get all that paper because that could impact pricing that you get in aggregate from that investor. So one of the things that we saw here is that folks actually sold to their rank one price, to the highest price, 69% of the time, which is up from 68% last month. And any execution sold to the fourth or worst price actually had the counter change. So it was 13% last month and then 12% this month. So we saw price be a bigger factor in like softer eligibility guidelines over the course of the month. Another interesting data point was servicing. So we saw servicing rights decrease in value by approximately 2 basis points over the course of the month. That makes sense because rates dropped. OBMI dropped 17 basis points over the course of the month. And when servicing rights decrease in value, it typically means that expectations of prepays have gone up. And when rates drop like that, you are expecting to see some prepayment activity. We also saw the best efforts mandatory spread increase for conforming loans, conforming 30-year loans up 4 basis points, while the government best effort mandatory spread remained flat at 13. We did see purchase pull-through rates increase about 170 basis points to almost 85% pull-through. That's really interesting given the fact that rates dropped this month. So I think what we potentially could be seeing there is folks that are maybe locked into long-term rate obligations. Think of, you know, 120, 180 day, maybe even 360 days of a rate lock, especially if you're a builder. And you could be seeing folks take advantage of float downs. And so you don't see that come out as true fallout. Now, any good hedger or any good cap markets team is going to probably still count that as a fallout in some ways, because that's a soft fallout. It doesn't really leave your position, but you do have to change your hedging strategy to account for that, right? Like getting out of a higher TBA coupon and moving into that lower TBA coupon does have a hedge cost associated with that. So you will see folks account for that. And we did see also refi pull through also increase to 62.6%. And that was up about 30 basis points. I'm going to flip back over to the production side just to round this out here. You know, we saw conforming loans make up 53% this month. That's up 110 basis points from last month. And so we could be seeing some of that flight to those more affordability-focused programs the last couple of months start to trend backwards now. We did see decreases across FHA loans down about 80 basis points, VA loans down about basis point, and we saw non-conforming loans down about 2 basis points as well from a share percentage. We saw FICO on average remain the same. It barely increased, moving from 732 to 733. We saw the average loan amount basically flat as well, barely changing about $50 over the course of the month. And we saw first-time homebuyer stats effectively flat throughout the course of the month. The last one I want to hit is expanded guidelines. This is our non-QM and kind of non-agency catch-all bucket. We saw that account for about 7.4% of originations this month, basically flat month over month. And this is basically just continuing that trend that I and others in the industry have been hammering, is that we've seen this share increase a lot over the course of the last year, and it's not really going anywhere. We haven't seen any real decrease there at all. So lenders have to continue to make sure they have a strategy in place for the pricing, originating, and hedging and trading of that asset.
Right. Thank you, Mike. And I think this is probably a good moment to remind folks that there's a lot more data available in our complete Market Advantage report, and you can subscribe for free on our website. We will have that link in our show notes. Thank you. It's time to welcome this month's guest. We have Rob Kessel joining us. He's founder of Panoramic Capital Advisory and Consulting. That's a professional development organization focused on capital markets training. Rob, welcome to the Market Advantage.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I know you might go way back, and I will turn it over to you two to have some secondary market banter here in a moment. But I thought maybe you could kick us off by telling us a funny anecdote or story about Mike when he was a little younger in his career.
Oh, gee, we don't have that much time, do we? No, I've been super fortunate. Back when we worked at Compass Analytics together, we brought in a new team of some of the best and brightest. You know, Mike is exhibit number one in that vein. It's been such a pleasure working with you through the years, and how quickly you picked up stuff and excelled at it. It was just amazing and wonderful to watch.
So Rob, maybe a good place to start would be telling us a little bit more about Panoramic and what you and your team are doing over there.
After selling Compass Analytics, I took some time off and, you know, ultimately decided that complete retirement just wasn't for me, and, you know, just wanted to be back in the industry and rekindle a lot of relationships, and looked where was a good fit. Turned out that there still wasn't good capital markets training out there in the industry. You know, so embarked upon the project of, you know, putting together what we never had at Compass. I think largely the industry hasn't had until Panoramic, and putting together all the content in the right order to provide the full context for training capital markets folks. We're two semesters in, and we've had great feedback and great fun with it. And it's a joy, being on this side, just on the education side of the business. Really fun.
Rob, to build on that, I always tell folks that it took me, while you said I picked it up quick, I think it took me at least 2 years to kind of put the pieces together. And you would learn maybe step 3 or step 7 or step 10, and then you would figure out step 1 like 6 months later. And then when you figured out that, oh, all these things add together to tell the full cohesive story of like how capital markets and the mortgage, you know, manufacturing process like tie together. I always tell people it was like a light bulb. Like I almost feel like I was, that came to me when I was reviewing maybe some of your training material on the Metro one day, that it all snapped straight. So it's really awesome to see that the class is set up in a way where it's sequential to build up on top of it. I don't know if you've gotten any feedback that is similar to that, or if you want to expand upon any of those thoughts there.
Well, you know, it's, and I appreciate those kind words, but there's so much jargon in our business. And, you know, there's this whole foundational approach to where understanding the participants in the industry and the roles they play, but, you know, very importantly, the jargon that's used, and then figuring out how to, you know, rewind all the way to the beginning and just lay down the necessary foundation so that when you, you know, need to reference something later on, there's an understanding of what it is you're referencing. And a couple of my compadres, James Bowblitz and Gary Malice, have participated in the sausage making of the class. And there's lots of arm wrestling around when we could introduce a topic and how deep we could go in a topic. And that's, I think it's been a pretty fruitful exercise in how we put it together.
Now, that's awesome. And I think that's probably a good segue maybe to some of the topics that we wanted to cover today. So we recently, in our Market Advantage monthly report, we added some secondary marketing focused data points. And we thought there was nobody better out there to talk to about these data points than yourself. So the one of the first ones that we really wanted to bring more of a light to is the best effort mandatory spread. And I remember when I was first getting started, this concept was very foreign to me. I'd never heard of a concept like this before outside of mortgage banking. So I was wondering if you can kind of first give us your interpretation of that spread and what that means, and then we'll dive a little bit deeper from there.
Yeah, I mean, so the originators in the space today all learn through practical experience that they can't get competitive pricing until they increase their investor base, until they increase their capital, until they start taking more risk on. And, you know, one milestone for many lenders is when they look at moving to closing their own loans and they get a warehouse bank. And the next milestone, of course, is when do they look at starting to hedge their loans? And instead of locking in every loan at origination time with a specific investor, you know, taking on the risk of fallout and market movement and hedging that through the close. When you go out and explain that kind of milestone to lenders, you know, they're always saying, well, what's in it? You know, why would I take on that risk, right? And, you know, certainly the best measure of that risk is what is the difference in price that you can, you know, receive selling a closed loan versus selling a loan on a best effort basis when you lock it in. And that, of course, is that mandatory best effort spread. And, you know, there, as you know, intimately, there's a lot of noise in that. You know, certainly locking a loan in for a 45-day lock when you accept the lock from the LO versus selling a closed loan on a mandatory 7-day delivery, that, you know, that creates some noise in that number. But that, you know, that's generally, you know, as a starting point, that's that general value of that spread. And it's moved in and out. But I'll leave it at that. I know you've got some fine points to bring up about it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think another way to think about it is that premium for like who's managing that risk, right? So in the best efforts world, the buyer or the investor of the loan is, they're susceptible to fallout, right? They're susceptible to interest rate risk on that loan post agreeing to a price, where the lender, then they, if they take that risk on, they're incentivized for it with that better price. And there's a variety of reasons why. You touched upon a couple with the different delivery terms, but there's different things that kind of pop in and out of that best effort price that occasionally actually maybe have it priced through mandatory. I don't know if there's anything, any tips or tricks that you've noticed over the years of like different scenarios where that happens.
You know, there's a, I'll even say the word trope in our business, which is never be complacent. And that is, you know, that's the beauty of having a PPE, right? Because you can assume that the mandatory price is going to be better, but you just never know. You know, really best practices would be that you would look at every best effort execution the same time you're looking at your mandatory execution. Just different investors have different appetites, axes for different products at different times, and one shouldn't be complacent. So to your point.
Yeah, love that point. And that's something that we really push on like our clients from a, you know, best X perspective and a hedging perspective is making sure you have every execution possible. And sometimes when we're working with different lenders, they might have a mandatory execution and a best effort execution for the same lender that they're using throughout the life cycle of the loan, whether it's at front end pricing all the way to loan sale. Because sometimes you see things where maybe there's a better spec pay up in a best effort price, or maybe there are some lenders who have different pay ups for things such as like a CRA axe that comes in through the best effort rate sheet. One of the things that we've actually started tracking is the split of loans that are actually sold best efforts at the point of loan sale, and we see that number somewhere in that 2-4% range. Which is enough that everyone should be including that in their best X, even if it's a 1Z or a 2Z there, if it's, you know, additional basis points, everybody needs that right now. Rob, is there any type of, you know, magic number out there for like a best effort mandatory spread that is like, hey, this is the screaming hot time to do this if you're not doing it? Can you, anything that, any like rules of thumb there from your perspective?
You know, I think like the long-standing, you know, 30-some year assumption, you know, generally still is relevant, 25 to 40 basis points. But, you know, it's the improvement in technology and all the things that have happened in our business, including loan level valuation and bidding, and to your point, CRA being passed through, maybe not through, maybe in some cases through best effort. Those are all things that kind of throw that assumption on its head, right? And so lenders still have to look at, you know, what is their cost to hedge? It's going to be at some level of volume play because that cost will be spread out over the loans. And then, you know, work through this 30, 40 basis point kind of number. And, you know, as we know, it's not, you can't guarantee what that spread's going to be. And there certainly are conditions where it's much better, and there are conditions where it's much less. And, you know, I'd say the last point I'd make is the move of the industry towards the whole loan bidding format, you know, has taken some of that best effort mandatory spread transparency out, because, you know, there are many investors that maybe only buy through just that bidding process. So it's added some challenge as well as opportunities, clearly.
Yeah, definitely. It has, you know, back up a couple of years, you know, every investor had their rate sheet that was out there that you could, I remember one of the first things that Compass was build our standardized, you know, LOPA template for all the different investors. You know, that was, you know, every investor had their own grid or their own type of an adjustment for MSRs or spec payups or things like that. And it's moved now to a world where they have like these living, breathing, dynamic models that are moving with the market every day. And every time you send out a loan sale, they're getting different pricing there. And so the technology there has been, it's really improved at the point of loan sale. I think you're starting to see people start to move that further up in the manufacturing process. So you see some investors who are using those models for mark-to-market bidding. And I think you'll continue to see that kind of move more towards the front of the originations process to put that best foot forward for folks. You've almost seen some of that best effort mandatory spread maybe move to secondary GL in some cases, because there's not as enough price discovery for the front end origination.
Yeah, it's one of those rare things where the GNL moves to secondary and not to the loan officers and the branches. That, yeah, I mean, it's still, I think you still have that risk. Like let's say you're just doing best efforts, and your strategy is to give loan officers the best of the best efforts. I mean, I know as hedge advisors, this is something that gives us, you know, indigestion when our clients want to do this kind of thing, because, you know, what happens that you know, that lender on that day might be priced very aggressively, but, you know, if you're hedging that loan over the next, you know, 45, 60 days, then who knows if they're going to back out. So there's always this kind of like, how far through is the best price compared to the second best price? And then, you know, you want to do right by your LOs and give them the most competitive price so they get the business. But if it's too far through, it's not in anyone's best interest for secondary to lose money by, you know, giving too much away, right? And I know that you know that intimately, and I'm sure you guys have pretty cool technology to help manage that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, the ability to kind of take a little bit of the guy who's sticking out, but also kind of grounding yourself to like where the majority of your pricing lives, it is really important. To Rob's point there, like the certainty of what you price on day one and your expected profitability is all correlated, right? It's you know, I've said this on the Honest Podcast before, it's like an X minus Y equals Z, right? And so if your X is very, very high and your Y is stable, well, then your profitability, which is Z, is gonna go up or down based upon that. So if you have this starting point that's kind of sticking out, it's very difficult to make sure that your Z is predictable. And with things that we do on rate sheet tools and different things with blending of pricing, we have a lot of interesting options there. But to your point, if you know, pricing best efforts, there's a lot of kind of like murkiness there in terms of like what is going into that price and how you track it and how you pull it apart. And it makes that GL attribution very difficult because the best effort spread changes every day. So it's a big hurdle for folks. You know, on that point, you know, I think we mentioned this a little bit during the conversation already, but another kind of like, you know, data point that we've started looking at is pull through. So was kind of hoping we would go through kind of a little bit the same exercise. If you can kind of give us, you know, your opinion on what pull through is, and then you and I can kind of go down memory lane of some of the things that we've worked on over the years on pull through.
Well, I clearly the, you know, if you try and simplify the hedging proposition, you know, not 100% of every loan is going to close, and you need to, you know, back off your hedge enough to where you're not over hedging and certainly not flip side either, under hedging the loan. And of course, that pull through is the assessment of the behavior of the borrower or the probability it will close, right? And to the extent you misspecify that, to the extent you fail to keep it updated, then you end up with, you know, hedge mismatch, right? And sometimes if the market sells off, that could be a win, but no one wants that win, right? They want a predictability of performance. They want to, you know, be on top of pull through. And so, you know, that's obviously the objective and the concept. You know, I think one of the things that not everyone in the industry agrees on is that, you know, what is the flip side of pull through? What is fallout? And, you know, so one of the things that I think, you know, and certainly in early days, you know, you and I spent a lot of time talking about is that, you know, hey, there's a type of fallout when there's a loan renegotiation, right? That, you know, if pull through models to prevent hedging losses, well, even if a loan closes, if it renegotiated, there was a hedging loss, right? Your loss on the hedge stayed the same, but if you renegotiate down in rate, your loan gain has evaporated or largely evaporated, right? You know, that was an important distinction in pull through, saying, you know, differentiating those loans that renegotiated as a type of fallout, and then being able to use that as an input variable to the pull through analysis. Certainly that was the one, you know, I think an important area of pull through analysis. And, you know, clearly the sky's the limit these days as people pay more attention to a lot more data and AI writ large, right?
Yeah. And I think it all goes back to that predictability of profitability, right? So, you know, kind of the summarize a couple of things you said there, like, you know, every application that you take in and load into your LOS isn't going to close, right? And so the hedger's job or the capital markets team is say, okay, well, how many of those applications that came in today and were locked are actually going to close? Like a simplistic example is like, hey, we have $1 million of new locks today, and then I want to hedge that basically at the same level as my pull through. So if my pull through is 70%, then I don't need a full $1 million hedge to hedge that loan. I need $700,000. And that changes as rates go up and down, as you move through the manufacturing process. And to Rob's like first point, you know, if the pull through changes, well, then you're adding or subtracting to your hedge. And every time you do that, there's a transaction cost, right? And to Rob's second point, which I can't agree with enough, and we worked over the years, and some of these reports still live and breathe with some added data points that we've added over the years. But the whole like almost like originator behavior or borrower behavior part, it's not always just interest rate. A lot of it is behavioral. And so, you know, some of these things that we look at can actually cause you to take on a hedge loss, even though the loan's still in the pipeline. So think about something like an extension, right? It might extend the loan longer than you initially expected. It's not just the amount of hedge you put on, but it's also the coupon slotting and then the settlement slotting of the loan. So if you extend the loan and it then is better matched with the July versus the June TBA, well, then you have to actually roll your coverage and take on transaction costs. If you switch products, if you switch rates and it changes you to drop coupon, that's gonna change your hedge, and you have to incur that hedge cost sooner than maybe you expected. Rob, from like going through your class, like were there any other like interesting operational, you know, things that came to light that maybe you know, some of the secondary marketing folks aren't thinking about with your like broader perspective here?
You know, I think the one thing that we try and work through in the class is making sure that there's perspective about why, you know, pricing strategies and how competitive, especially today's plays, it has to be, and maybe why that leads to concessions. And it's kind of the margin journey, right? It's a margin journey from what maybe the management thinks is the margin to what shows up on the rate sheet that gets adjusted to then maybe suffers from a concession to then maybe suffers from an extension, to your point, or renegotiation later on. I think to protect the back of secondary or the secondary vendor, right, is to just provide more transparency to where that P&L goes. And the fact that, yes, a concession comes right out of margin typically, or that a renegotiation, yes, you can calculate a P&L impact, and it comes right out of your margin, your corporate margin. And, you know, through sunlight's the greatest, disinfectant, right? Like, it, just by educating everyone and having everyone understand each other's perspectives, the hope is that people get to the right spot with how they approach things.
Yeah, and I think your point on sunlight is like spot on. Like, being able to show folks that, like, hey, this is where you fit from a pull through perspective, but then also not just like what we would call like your top line, right? Like, what is just like, did the loan close, but like, did it close with a renegotiation? And maybe there are things that you could like tighten up operationally. So being able to show different originators, hey, your branch or your channel or your LO sits here, and he compares to the rest of your peers. This is a report that we used at Compass, and we still use today at Optimal Blue, the originator scorecards. But it just is such a powerful concept, that idea of sunlight on that. From your perspective, any interesting like trends or rules of thumb on different channels versus different products, from interesting pull through trends you've noticed?
I think there's a lot of, I think people are going to put more and more energy into that with AI, and I'm sure you guys are all about that, because there's a lot of the behavioral stuff that there's probably related to the processing alone. So there's I'm sure that's going to be a trend. I think that the whole how you get pricing to rate sheet, and what this is more of a margin concept, but the big aggregators that are buying, it's, as you've experienced, super interesting just how differently they value MSRs. Same loan, but two investors might have, two correspondent investors might have 75 basis points different price that you can only relate to the servicing asset. I mean, and that of course maybe is a recapture play, but that's like a very, big window to drive a you can drive a truck through, that makes it hard to kind of figure this stuff out. And that's back to the whole transparency, right? Why can they do that? How do they do that? What are their assumptions? And what as a lender do you do to protect yourself?
Yeah. And I think you hit a really good point there in terms of pull through and just general like speeds or prepay are kind of related in terms of the impact of interest rates. Now, I do think that there is differences on pull through from the standpoint of all these different things that are happening during the origination part of the loan. And, just generally, like, we see, pull through on like purchase loans typically closer to like 80%, and then refis closer to like the 65-ish range. I think that makes a ton of sense just based upon, hey, you start working with a real estate agent to go buy that first home. Maybe you are a first-time home buyer, maybe not. You haven't gone through the process yet. You're more likely, maybe not, to shop. But then on the refi, you've at least been through it one time already. You could see some of the differences of rate and some of those intangible things that I think might be gained during the home buying process. It becomes more commoditized, I think, during that refi piece. So it's more about like dollars and cents than it is a relationship, in my opinion. So I think that's some things that we've noticed there. And you alluded to this too. It's a ripe spot for automation and some of the new technologies that are out there. We just got out of our hackathon. There was another podcast from Optimal Blue that just talked about that, and it was a ripe subject of our hackathon, of like what we could do with AI and large language models and machine learning models to figure out how to crack that nut, because it drives such a huge piece of profitability, but it's still one of those dark arts, I feel like, in a certain extent. Like, it's one of those, you think it's a science, it really should be a science, but it does take a capital markets professional to kind of look at previous data and be like, oh, okay, this makes sense because rates have trended up and we haven't seen down rate shocks, or I don't have enough sample size and certain moves. There's a lot of human intuition still in pull-through modeling, but I think we wake up in 2 or 3 years, maybe even sooner, and I think it's going to be a very different state of the world there.
Yeah, I think the funny thing is the wholesale purchase and refi pull-through has largely been those numbers for 30 years. So one, I think the benefit of transparency is going to provide data and information, which I think will actually be implemented as workflow changes that's going to start to impact that pull through. Like, if you have events you can identify, what can you put into your LOS? What can you feed your LO that can now start to actually change the outcome of that pull through? And I think that's, once there's more transparency and discovery of what's actually impacting pull through, the next wave will be, okay, now we're going to do something about it.
Yeah. And I wish I could give more detail, but you like highlighted the number one winner of the hackathon there. So you're going to see something from Optimal Blue more on this to come here. But just using that as our segue here to the next topic, before I give away any like company secrets on the podcast, I wanted to touch upon loan sales, right? So when we talked about the best efforts to mandatory spread conversation, it kind of culminates with this decision that a lender has to make. The lender has to make a decision on how to get rid of that loan. Like a lot of these lenders, especially IMBs, you know, they borrow from warehouse banks overnight to fund the loan, and then they need to go out and sell the loan to actually pay down the warehouse banks and then do that 1,000 more times. You know, depositories have a little bit more wiggle room there, but the choice of how lenders sell loans and the different delivery methods is a really important strategic conversation and decision lenders have to make. So Rob, I was wondering if you can give us some insight into just, you know, some of the different delivery methods and how lenders sell loans today.
Well, you know, I think just kind of comparing against 15 years ago, it used to be easier for a lender at a smaller size to both be able to securitize and to sell cash. And you've seen a lot of that, you know, a lot of the agencies have pushed a lot of lenders into selling cash. And it's just the bigger lenders that had the securitization option. So you see that kind of options taken away a little bit, and that old school AOT 10 plus years ago has been replaced now with, bid loan, individual loan bid tapes with hybrid AOT, right? And so, you know, it's certainly in the interest of the lender, given their capital and strategic decisions, to figure out what are their investors and which delivery options they'll allow, right? And you know, and co-issue is another flavor of that if they're selling to the agency. And it's I think the flip side of don't be complacent, always do the work to figure out best execution, is also getting into the relationship with the investor a little bit and your own operations. Like the best price for a single loan isn't always the very best execution, right? If it involves operational expense, certainly if you're optimizing pools and you can move loans around, then maybe you lose best execution on one loan to enable best execution across a broader set of loans. And there is the importance of the investor relationship. You know, that if you listen to the aggregators out there, you know, they certainly represent themselves in the value of a good relationship where it's not always everything price. And I think the more mature lenders increasingly explore and deepen their relationships with the aggregators to deliver loans to them in a way that, you know, works for both of them and is appropriate. Those would be kind of the add-ons I consider.
No, definitely. That makes a ton of sense. And, you know, when we sit back and look at the data that we see, we approximately cover about 40-odd% of all the loans hedged and traded in the secondary market. You know, I mentioned before we see best efforts execution somewhere in that 2-4% range. You know, we see folks who sell to the bulk loan sale piece about 32-35% of the time. That's where loans are sold today. And then Rob mentioned this earlier as well, like that's when you're selling the whole loan, you know, principal, interest, and servicing to a investor. And they sometimes will also let you sell the hedge to them as well. So you can get that risk neutral transaction. And then we see the rest of it kind of going to the agency side, whether it's a mix of cash or MBS. We saw, you know, just last month, for example, about 36% of our loans sold through an MBS securitization. Now that's skewed towards some of the bigger folks who have the economies of scale there to do that, and they might have more robust of teams. There's a little bit more of a reporting kind of aspect there to handle. On the cash side, we're about 27%. You know, Rob, just from your perspective, you know, any of those numbers stand out to you as interesting? And then if not, like what are some of the distinctions and the considerations for folks to, at least on the agency side, think about going cash versus MBS?
It seems to me, just from what I hear, that it's, you know, the agency's kind of predilection to, you know, encourage lenders or maybe limit lenders to one or the other. And it seems that it's increasingly been restricting them to cash. And, you know, so compared to 15 years ago where you could do both, right? But they just didn't want you to best X each other. So I think that's kind of given to the lender these days. You know, certainly lenders that deliver to agencies now have much more co-issue opportunities. They don't have to invest in the servicing asset. They don't need the capital or take that risk on. And so, you know, I think that's made agency cash sales more available to more. And the technology that's been brought to that realm moves that execution into more of a real-time kind of proposition that could be, you know, tailed right into, you know, against the totally released bid tape executions, you know. And so the technology has picked up such that, you know, the capital markets folks can make a true best execution that's timely. So, you know, those numbers don't surprise me. I'm sure there's big delivers that are selling on the MBS side. You know, last bastion is how prevalent the spec payups and story bonds have become. And, you know, clearly agencies try and pass a fair amount of that through in their cash pricing, but, you know, there's still probably, you know, non-trivial stuff left that if you were a securitizer, you might capture. And certainly they're doing that on the Ginnie side, right, where they don't have that cash option.
And I think a lot of it has to do with like some of the minimums and some of the smaller spec stories, like that folks can really only sell cash right now. So you do see some of those, maybe some of the mission score specs and maybe some of the home possible home readies that we want to incentivize from an affordability perspective, in mission perspective, but they may not be enough to securitize. So I think there are a couple folks who are maybe have a half foot in some of them to keep up with some of those goals. But yeah, it definitely seems like it's a pick your own lane. But some of the technology, to your point, some of the servicing release execution, you know, improvements that both agencies have made to bring the co-issue bid in one kind of fell swoop to this execution has really helped them bring more liquidity there, in my opinion, because that was something that like humans used to have to manage, right? We used to have to manage, so-and-so co-issue guy has changed their bid. Let's go have a human look at an Excel spreadsheet and then put those adjusters into a model, as opposed to it just flowing through into the decision-making process.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And pivoting off that, I think another topic I wanted to hit was you talked about the concept of like of things being not always price driven. And so I wanted to get your reaction on a number that we track in our report. So in our report today, we track how much of the loan sales are actually done at the best price, with the idea here that some of the things that you mentioned on a relationship standpoint do impact things. So last month, we had this quoted at 70% is actually sold to rank one. And then it actually was, it was basically 8 and then 9% and 2 and 3. And then the rest of it was actually in rank 4. So rank 4 or lower being the second highest kind of like grouping from our reporting standpoint. I was interested in your perspective on that. And, you know, if there were other things that maybe outside just relationship that could potentially be impacting this trend that we've seen.
But it surprised me that it's 70%. I mean, I think that I would almost expect it to be higher just because of how tough, you know, it is right now to compete. You know, I think that that this is another ring out for complacency, that, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that are made. And, you know, I think that you can, you know, I think if I recall correctly, you can actually with your rankings, you know, monetize that difference exactly. Like it's back 17 basis points, right? You know, first thing I'd be thinking of if I'm, you know, in that stat where my department's selling at 70%, you know, I'm looking at that 30 and saying, what is that in dollars and cents and why? And, you know, what is the logic behind that? And chances are it makes perfect sense, but it's also possible that there's some complacency setting in where for whatever reason, it's easier to do this. And maybe they're not looking at the magnitude of dollars. You know, 5 basis points isn't that much unless it's on $1 billion, right? And then it's a lot. And especially if our corporate margins are, you know, hopefully 50 basis points, right? So it's 10%. So, you know, it's always get into the data if you've got it and monetize it and, you know, make it transparent and then tell that into your strategy decision.
Yeah. And to wrap up on that point too, like, you know, a lot of the technology that's out there lets you take some of these, like what I call like softer guidelines and have them automated, right? So you might be, oh, I know that this type of loan takes X more days at this investor, so I'm going to sell it someplace else and move it away from the best X. A lot of those things can be easily programmed or configured in technology out there, Optimal Blue is included, especially Compass Edge, so that like you're like, you don't have to do that manual thing. It will slot there based upon your eligibility criteria or your operational process, or managing something like a representative mix, making sure you're not delivering too much of a certain cohort to a certain investor. Back to that relationship point, right? You want to give them a full view of your entire business and origination process. So there's things there to make that easier. And then another thing to consider too here is if you're moving that loan away at the point of loan sale, that probably means that you're marking it to market and maybe even coming up with pricing for it at the point of origination that was not as accurate as it could have been. So it could have made your X and that formula I talked about earlier higher than you really should have offered previously. And it could look like a secondary loss. We talked about secondary gains earlier, but nobody wants a secondary loss either. So making sure that everything is aligned between the loan sale to origination is a really important point.
Absolutely. And your point about representative mix, I just want to emphasize that there is, you don't want to, you know, quote, arb an investor by dumping stuff on them that, you know, ultimately leads them to think that you're delivering poor credit or just poor performing to take advantage of a short-term price. And I think your point about representative mix and having the analytics and as you do your loan sales is a very critical piece to long-term profitability, but and as well with relationships with the investors.
Yeah, nobody wants to get arbed. If someone thinks they're getting arbed, they're going to probably decrease your pricing. So it's, you don't want to let the short-term dollar signs impact long-term viability.
So I have the unfortunate job of keeping an eye on the clock. As much as I hate interrupting you two, I think, Rob, it's probably safe to say we would love to have you back again in the future because I know there's so much more you and Mike could chat about. But I do want to end by asking one more question of you, Rob. So we ask every guest what we call our bonus question. So that is, what is one thing, in your opinion, that you think lenders should be doing today to maximize profitability?
100% honest, completely transparent, beginning to end margin, actual realized margin tracking.
Short and sweet. I like it. So, Rob, thank you so much for joining us, spending time here, sharing your knowledge. And to our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about what Rob and his team are doing at Panoramic Capital, we will be sure to put a link to their website in our show notes so you can learn more. But in the meantime, take care.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.